You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
They will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
And North Korea speaks highly of him. My guests Michael Binion and Shashank Joshi will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including claims of chicanery as votes are counted in Kenya, the ongoing attempts of Venezuela's president to pretend that everything is just fine, and France's decision that it can live without a first lady. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist at The Times, and Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both. And we will start by looking at what has been an exciting 24 hours for anyone who has ever wondered what it would be like to reenact the Cuban Missile Crisis with the roles made famous by John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev performed by Beavis and Butthead. US President Donald Trump more or less explicitly threatened nuclear war upon North Korea, whose leader Kim Jong-un reportedly contemplated a preemptive strike upon the U.S. island territory of Guam. In the last few hours, members of Trump's circle, in between wishing they'd taken that job in the slaughterhouse, have begun walking the president's outburst back. First of all, here is Guam's governor, Eddie Calvo.
My Homeland Security advisor, who is in communications with Homeland Security and the Department of Defense, notes that there is no change in the threat level resulting from North Korea events. I've reached out to the White House this morning. An attack or threat on Guam is a threat or attack on the United States. They have said that America will be defended. And I also want to remind the national media that Guam is American soil. And we have 200,000 Americans in Guam and the Marianas. We are not just a military installation.
He might also have mentioned, Michael, that there are a great many Americans, including at least 30,000 soldiers in South Korea. This stuff from Trump, that is all nonsense, isn't it, until we start to see America evacuating large numbers of people?
Yes. On the other hand, there are various things that Mr. Trump can do which aren't just nonsense and might back up the rhetoric, such as start moving ships with troops and other things into South Korea or closer to South Korea, putting his troops on high alert, readying the military for any possible preemptive strike. We haven't seen any of that yet, but that could happen.
Shashank, we do need to address, I think, before we look at the detail here, the always key evergreen question where Trump is concerned. Does he actually have the least idea what he's saying from one moment to the next, or do things just pop into his head and he says them?
I think this is born of a real sense of frustration. You know, he's watched as his intelligence agencies have said North Korea can miniaturize a nuclear warhead in past days. It's conducted two ICBM tests, which haven't been stopped. The range is now comfortably able to reach the east coast of the United States. And I think that although this is not thought through as part of a policy process, it's clearly intended to try and intimidate Kim Jong-un into stopping this nuclear advance, this progress. The challenge is that he's confusing two types of threats. One of them is a deterrent threat that says, if you attack the United States or our allies, you will be destroyed. And that's, I think, a very useful kind of threat. It's one that all presidents have delivered or their advisors have delivered in various ways, with something much more reckless, which is, if you advance, we may strike you anyway, even if you don't hit us with nuclear weapons first. It's a threat of preventive warfare. And I think that's really dangerous. And he's doing this in an instinctive way. But of course, Kim may read this in a much, much more sensitive and escalatory manner, I think.
Well, this is the key question, isn't it, Michael? And we have seen the familiar dynamic now, or the by now familiar dynamic, during the several decades during which Trump now seems to have been president, of he says something and the next 24 hours are filled by his increasingly weary inner circle attempting to explain what he actually meant. But Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has attempted, after a fashion, to defend Trump's rhetoric, saying that this is the kind of language that Kim Jong-un understands. Do we give Trump a pass on that basis? Or is Tillerson working a bit hard here?
Well, I think Tillerson is possibly right in that this is the sort of language that Kim Jong-un himself uses all the time.
I mean, almost literally, the lake of fire trope indeed. Is a favourite device of North Korea's news agencies.
That's right. That's what they say. I don't know whether Mr. Trump actually deliberately employed the same sort of rhetoric. I don't think he did. I think that's the way he thinks as well. And he just said it. But it is true. Hearing it, Kim Jong-un may think, yes, this is serious. On the other hand, knowing himself that all he talks is propaganda most of the time anyway, he may also discount it as propaganda from Trump at the same time.
And that's very dangerous, right? Because we don't know what Trump's intentions are here. If he really just means to say, don't attack the United States, don't attack South Korea, and we'll let your regime survive, which is Rex Tillerson signalling, saying we don't want to change the regime, we don't seek to go above the 38th parallel, we don't seek to overthrow you, that's fine. But of course, if he means, if you conduct another nuclear test, we may conduct limited strikes, we may conduct a bigger campaign, and Kim writes it off, as you're implying he might do, thinking, well, this is all bluster, it was bluster when I said it, it's bluster when Trump says it. This is a profoundly dangerous possibility because it really could end up in sort of miscalculation and outright conflict. And I think at the end of this, the people who would be really the worst off, absolutely the worst off, would be the Koreans themselves and the Japanese. And for them, they'll be asking, what's the point of an alliance intended to protect us that could end up incinerating us?
Michael, we get here, don't we, into the wilder reaches of game theory, familiar to those of us sufficiently venerable to remember the Cold War.
Or, as I saw on Twitter today, Guam theory.
Ah, very good. Someone's done very well
I'll
there.
I'll leave now.
But there was a doctrine that did prevail, certainly early on, in the early stages of the nuclear arms race, the use them or lose them doctrine. This was this idea that prevailed among some of the more hawkish US defense officials, that if we were going to get into it with the Soviet Union, then best to hit them now while they were relatively weak and before they hit us.
Oh, indeed.
Might North Korea actually end up thinking that way?
They might, yes. I mean, there was a famous remark by one of the Republican campaign, presidential candidates, Barry Goldwater, who pretty loose-lipped and also pretty bellicose, who once just, and a throwaway remark.
God, who you'd take back in a heartbeat now, wouldn't you?
Well, he just said, let's drop one in the men's room in Moscow and take out the Soviet leadership. I mean, that was actually what he said. But he was resoundingly defeated because most Americans realized that kind of hawkish, loose-lipped rhetoric actually was pretty dangerous and rather silly.
I mean, there's another danger here as well, isn't there, Shashank, which is that because Trump has made this all about him, as Trump makes absolutely everything he touches all about him, there is a kind of a danger that the world forgets that the problem here actually is North Korea. I mean, North Korea actually is a paranoid, volatile, potentially incredibly dangerous regime, increasingly armed with extremely serious weapons, and that is bad.
Yes, I think there's a certain point beyond which we shouldn't take the Trump-Kim comparison too far. You know, one is a democratic leader, however, you know, tangerine and bellicose, and the other is a brutal tyrant who starves his people and has committed atrocities in that sense. But, you know, the world is, I think, has an eye on this. We're only a few days on from a pretty impressive vote at the United Nations, 15-0, to sanction North Korea for, I think, the 12th time since its very first nuclear test, or the 8th time perhaps in 2006. I think the world recognises that North Korea is the problem, but actually at a certain point it also recognises it's a problem with no easy solution. And I personally think the sooner we rid ourselves of the delusion that they will denuclearise, the quicker we can get round to realising they have to be deterred. And you have to deter them with precise, careful language, not the kind of imprecise, instinctive words used by the president in an improvised way.
Or perhaps with the kind of sanctions that only China could put on them, economic sanctions that would really, really hurt. Now, that China could provoke the collapse of the regime if it wished.
So, and I think that's one theory with the part of the Trump administration, which is to say, if you threaten a war that has devastating consequences, that's the only thing that would make China think that pressure on North Korea with the attendant risk of collapse is still a preferable alternative to the kind of preventive strike that could be launched by Trump. So in other words, showing them that the alternative to Chinese biting sanctions is going to be a devastating war. I think the problem is the Chinese don't quite believe it.
Yes.
But perhaps they will if we continue down this path.
If they believed it, that's a perfectly reasonable strategy to pursue. But, as you say, within moderation, because otherwise the Chinese would just say this is so absurd and extreme and they wouldn't believe it either. But if they thought that the world was on the brink of nuclear warfare, then they would probably step up their pressure on North Korea. What they don't want is the immediate implosion of that regime with thousands or millions fleeing and a complete chaos and bringing American-backed power right up to their own frontier.
Just a final thought on this one from you, Michael. I get the impression, or at least this is my own impression, that the Western media has been, to a large extent, rather enjoying the last few days, crisis, panic, et cetera, at an otherwise fairly slow time of year. But in order to reassure myself, I always look at the news agencies and newspapers and social media of Seoul, where there seems to be a remarkable absence of panic. Should that tell us something?
Yes, the South Koreans are pretty good North Korea watchers, though, of course, they also are subject to wild speculation from time to time, and they don't really have a firm grip necessarily on what's going on, the internal dynamics of the leadership in the North. A lot of it is based on rumour and stories from defectors. But it does seem that the South Koreans just feel this is yet another repetition of the kind of thing we've seen before all too often. What I think they should be concerned about is that more than likely Mr. Un, or whatever, Kim Jong-un, Mr. Kim, yes, that's him, he will vent his fury not on Guam, but on a target in South Korea. That's what he normally tends to do.
Well, let's take a look now at Kenya, where, perhaps unsurprisingly, President Uhuru Kenyatta appears to have been returned in yesterday's presidential election. Equally unsurprisingly, his opposition are not having it. Kenyatta's principal opponent, Raila Odinga, has alleged that the Electoral Commission's IT system has been hacked to the advantage of the incumbent. This is prompting a measure of nervousness in those who recall Kenya's 2007 presidential election, arguments over the legitimacy of which left more than 1,000 people dead, 600,000 displaced, and President Kenyatta facing charges of crimes against humanity, later dropped by the ICC. Shashank, first of all, Mr. Odinga is claiming to have been robbed, as indeed he did in 2007. How seriously should these claims be taken? We have not as yet been favoured with irrefutable documentary proof.
These are provisional results, and Odinga's theory is a little bit elaborate. It's that the computer systems of the National Election Commission, its databases were tampered with, effectively to produce errors that would systematically favour Kenyatta. And it's been sort of lent some plausibility in Kenya by the fact that a key election commission official was murdered in rather suspicious circumstances, perhaps having been tortured at some point before the vote. I think really it's very hard to draw any firm judgments. We need to sort of wait for some of the observers in the country to report back. But my sense is from the early media reporting on this that this may be a case of sour grapes. This may be there may really be problems, there may have been errors, but I'm not necessarily sure that it was quite as distorted as we saw 10 years ago in that devastating campaign that you mentioned.
The thing is that the murder you mention, and this is of the unfortunate Christopher Msando, who helped develop the IT for the new voting system, is one of those things where even if you don't usually subscribe to the tinfoil hat theory of events, and I generally myself very much don't, this is the kind of thing at the very least which could have been calculated rather to cause that sort of speculation, isn't it? I mean, Mr. Odinga's theory is that Msando login details for the system were tortured out of him and therefore used to hack the system. Is it slightly irresponsible of Odinga to be flamming this one up if he doesn't have the goods?
Well, it's irresponsible certainly if he doesn't have the goods, but it's not unexpected because he is a person, I think I agree entirely with Shashank, it's sour grapes. I do think the basic evidence is that he lost, and that however much one tries to say there were tamperings here or there were irregularities there, the size of the vote was such that the margin of difference was such that he clearly didn't beat Kenyatta, And he is trying to find every excuse to show that this was a fake election, a false election, that the results were tampered with in order to either to rerun it or to simply try to get his supporters to come out on the streets and possibly even threaten a repeat of 2007. Now, it is very convenient that this murder happened because it does feed into a plausible theory of some kind of tampering, the idea that the codes for the electoral computer system were taken from this man and therefore allowed hackers to get into it. We simply don't know. But I think it's a last throw of Odinga. He is 72. This is the last time he's likely to contest an election. He's tried already several times before and been defeated each time. And I think he's just going to throw everything into it now in the hope that he can somehow change the result.
Shashak, if Kenyatta wants to look like, or to, I guess, forestall any doubt or debate that this has been a legitimate victory for him, what does he need to do, especially in terms of, investigating and apportioning blame for the murder of Mr. Msando?
I think there's got to be a sort of a sense that you take allegations seriously. The Election Commission has to be allowed to do its work. There are external observers, particularly EU observers, who have enormous experience in this, who are saying, we are looking into this, give us time. I think the most important thing is, first of all, he'll have to be open-minded. He'll have to avoid sort of completely shutting down these claims. And I think he'll have to be effectively willing to not interfere in the process that is going to go on in this. And of course, this is the problem. There's a sense of, zero-sum competition in these environments where the incumbent, even if they would like to have an investigation, feels if they sit back, if they give any space to their opponent, not just in Kenya but elsewhere too, ultimately, the power of the street will pressure them or force them out of office. And I think it's really rather tragic that another opposition candidate has chosen to deploy supporters in this way in raw numbers rather than allow a process to take hold. And we've seen this again and again in these weakly constituted democracies.
And particularly, he's using the tribal card. He's playing the ethnic differences. And this is a very powerful one. And once you bring that in, our tribe was discriminated against. He comes from a minority tribe, the Luo. The president comes from the majority Kikuyu tribe, or the largest tribe, and once you start getting those differences as the key issue, then all rational thought goes out of the window.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Michael Binion and Shashank Joshi. Coming up next, Venezuela, where President Maduro's parallel parliament has begun making its mark.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Michael Binion and Shashank Joshi. Now, Bertolt Brecht speculated in his 1950s poem The Solution that the way forward for any beleaguered government might be to dissolve the people and elect another. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro increasingly appears to be attempting exactly that. His recently established Constituent Assembly, an obvious enough exercise in circumventing the country's actual parliament, proposes to create something ominously billed as a Truth Commission. Michael, the Assembly was first supposed to be rewriting the Constitution to the President's advantage, which was weird enough, I guess, but this new initiative following the sacking of the Chief Prosecutor, Luisa Ortega, are we learning here that this Constituent Assembly has been assembled basically to do whatever it is that Nicolas Maduro decides he wants it to do?
Absolutely, no question about it. It's stacked with his supporters. It's the brainchild of several of his henchmen.
Literally all of its decisions so far have been unanimous.
Yes. I mean, this
doesn't sound suspicious. What are you implying here?
And even using this Orwellian idea of a sort of truth commission, it's actually a lies commission. It will determine who has told lies and therefore who is betraying running the country. I mean, it's almost giving carte blanche to the arrest or prosecution of anyone who is questioning the legitimacy of what has happened. And that is what they appear to be setting about to do.
The Truth Commission, it says here, Shashank, will investigate, and I quote, acts of violence carried out with political motives or out of intolerance. Which is an addition I'm quietly tickled by. This is a manifesto for show trials, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't want to trivialise the fact that there has been some violence against, you know, the state in Venezuela.
Has.
You know, the UN said about 8 members of security forces have died. There have been attacks on bases, and this is a profoundly worrying thing for, you know, all of Venezuela's neighbours. We don't want to see state breakdown or the militarisation of the conflict in a major way. But look, all the power really rests with the state. Over 125 people have been killed. I would imagine most of them are anti-regime protesters. And the institutions of the state are being systematically either destroyed or appropriated by one faction to preserve its grip on power. And for me, you know, this is just really highlights. We have been focused on right-wing populist authoritarians for the last few years, you know, in soft versions like Poland or Hungary and harder versions elsewhere. And, you know, left-wing populism run by demagogues who are willing to appropriate the state and bend it to its will are a serious problem. And, you know, they are just as willing to undermine the state and independent institutions as their right-wing military dictator counterparts.
The only difference, perhaps, is that this particular government or junta or whatever one wants to call the dictatorship has actually not only bankrupted the country, but left it critically short of food and medicine, virtually all basic requirements for normal people. And as a result, you are stoking up a resentment that is going to explode at some point, and may include also some of the supporters of the regime, and certainly may include the military.
Well, this is one of the many things I don't understand about what Maduro's doing, is that even if you try to look at this from his point of view, and obviously what he wants is to stay in power, is this actually going to work for him?
I don't think so. What it will do is sideline the vocal and so far legitimate voice of opposition, which is the parliament, which is controlled by the opposition. Once you have effectively said that that is treason, or that this is no longer a body that has any authority, then you've silenced to some extent the voice of the opposition, and you only then allow street protests. Now, street protests can then be suppressed by the military, and you try to keep the voice of the anger coming from the people at bay as long as possible. That's presumably the aim.
So, Michael, I mean, you and I have looked at the Arab world for a long time, and it's very, very clear that the military often is the pivot of these kind of situations.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting to see Maduro really invest so much in trying to keep the military support. I mean,
for obvious enough reasons.
I noted that he promoted 195 officers to the rank of general in one day, when the total number of generals in Venezuela to 2,000, and 11 of the 23 state governors in Venezuela are current or retired generals. So there's a really
2,000 generals.
2,000 generals.
Except
right,
the generals' pay probably won't even afford a day's inflation now.
Well, I think that may be correct, but of course he's also channeling all kinds of privileges such as access to food and high-end luxury goods to the regime elite, including generals. So I think a lot of this will hinge on support of the security forces, whether he can keep it. And of course, we know from, again, the Arab examples, ultimately even the best resourced countries can crack if a critical mass of generals defect. And that's happening in trickles so far, but I think it could easily slide in a matter of days.
Well, that's often where these things stand or fall. It is, Michael, it's no small change for if push comes to shove for a soldier to be asked to fire on his own people. If they won't do it, that's the point at which you've lost the argument if you're the person in
charge. Yes, absolutely. You can only run a regime that is so ruthless, that is prepared to shoot any general who doesn't clearly toe the line immediately, and then or get other generals to shoot those generals, as Saddam Hussein did. That was the way
he kept
the military in control. If you are ruthless to the point of Stalinism times 10, then you can continue that way. But I don't think the apparatus of terror is yet set up or established enough in Venezuela to allow him to do that.
I think it's important to realise also he's in a quite tight spot internationally speaking. I mean, just within his neighbours, within Mercosur, he's been kicked out of that regional organisation. organizations have condemned his actions. Venezuela is fairly isolated. You know, it's not getting really viable support. It doesn't have strong regional allies. Well, has Jeremy Corbyn, but I mean, outside of that sort of band of support, I wonder in the long term how tenable his position is in that sense as well.
Well, let's take a look finally at France, where the recently elected president, Emmanuel Macron, is enjoying one of the brisker honeymoons ever conducted in Paris. His approval rating upon election about 5 minutes ago was 62%. It is now 36% and falling. Among the factors exciting this dissatisfaction is a row over the role to be played by the president's wife, Brigitte Macron. President Macron wants her to be officially entitled First Lady and endowed with a budget and staff. France, on the available evidence, doesn't. Michael, the idea of a first spouse at all, is it just something we assume is normal because America has one and makes a big thing of it? Is it actually, when you look at it, kind of weird?
It's a bit weird, but inevitably, spouses are having to play a visible role because all politics becomes personality politics, and so much European politics consists of leaders of the country jetting off to summits or meeting each other all the time, having dinners, having a whole kind of family gathering, and spouses are always brought along willy-nilly. Some manage to leave their spouses behind. Angela Merkel's rather grumpy physicist spouse doesn't really go to anything much unless pushed, but most of them bring the spouses along, and it's quite an effort. I mean, you know, they play a real role. They have to. And there is the feeling, well, shouldn't they be somehow rewarded or recognised or at least compensated for the cost of having to buy something presentable to wear or whatever? Now, the idea that the First Lady should be an official position, of course, is particularly grated in France now because at the same time, the president is trying to cut all family connections for MPs. They can't.
Timing is everything.
Well, that's right. Having just said you can't employ your secretary, your wife as your secretary, or your son-in-law as your researcher, or anything like that.
Although, and this is genuinely a thing that has come up, you can, of course, still employ your mistress as your secretary.
Well, isn't that absurd? I mean, that's too absurd. Of course, the difficulty is then establishing precisely who is your mistress.
Which amongst them do you pick from in the French cases? But my favourite thing about, you know, you talked about the burden of spouses attending these functions. My favourite story of this is from the G20 summit, where Shinzo Abe's wife was sat next to Donald Trump, and became apparent that she has faked not being able to speak English to avoid having to converse with Trump, because a video emerged shortly afterwards of her giving an entire keynote address in English. So clearly she deserved substantial compensation for that particular task.
Michael, you mentioned there the fact, as you say, that the first spouse, as it were, is expected to play a role and turn up at things and be appropriately dressed, etc., etc. But who would actually care if they didn't? Is this just one of those, you know, obsessions fabricated out of thin air by the media? Is it possible to imagine an electorate turning on an otherwise competent leader just because their wife or husband decided they had better things to do than go to another EU summit this weekend?
No, I think that is possible, but it's just not really happened. As I say, the only time where visibly the spouse has not been there is Angela Merkel's husband, who clearly has no interest in playing a political subordinate role and doesn't really much pay much attention. I have to say also that Margaret Thatcher's husband didn't care for much unless there was a gin and tonic at the end of a golf course. He wasn't really interested in turning up to anything much.
Well, I mean, Philip May, you know, has an awkward British television interview. Yeah. But I suppose he hasn't done an awful lot more. I mean, even Sherry Blair kept up her very successful career as a barrister.
Indeed,
throughout
so.
Her time,
I mean,
in office.
Is this just one of those things where, as is so often the case, this is other countries having US president envy, that they wish that their head of government, you know, was able to sort of travel and be exalted in such grandeur and splendor?
I think that may be part of it. I think France is also an interesting case because it combines both elements. France, the office of the president is, you know, it's imbued with real gravitas and power in France, right? It is categorically different to a British prime minister, and it's a national symbol, it's a sort of pomp and glory and power.
The British still have the royal family for that.
Well, right, we have precisely. We're not going to have Prince Philip anymore because he just retired. But at the age of 96, I think he's allowed to have a rest.
But on the French side, and that's tempered by a kind of perhaps an egalitarian spirit. spirit, a sense of avoiding presidents getting too big for their boots, that I think holds some of this in check. Although, look, she's still getting paid. She has an office. This is just about a name, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that does bring us to the end of today's show. Michael Binion and Shashank Joshi, thanks both very much for joining us. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jonathan Whitfield. Our studio manager was Josh Prince. More music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. More on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'll be your host for that as well. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.